May the words of my mouth and thoughts of my heart be acceptable before you, O God, my rock, my redeemer. Shalom and welcome all to our ongoing series entitled An Orthodox Rabbi Reads the Christian Bible. And as you all know, I got an official introduction here that I have to put at the beginning of each and every class just to make sure that we understand where we're coming from when we do this lesson. So, let me read. My purpose and intent in teaching this course is simple. I want to be able to explain why Torah Judaism and Torah faithful Jews do not and will not accept or embrace the teachings of the Christian religion. I have no intentions or desires in this course to attack the religion of Christianity. I am not here to challenge or critique those who embrace the Christian faith. I am not here to talk about Christianity at all, even though due to the nature of this material, I am sure that I will not be able to avoid the topic entirely. Nevertheless, I am here to look at the Christian Bible from an entirely Torah point of view. I begin with certain premises. I do not deny the existence of an historical Yeshu, be he called Yeshua or what. But Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be the Messiah of Israel. But Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be God, or even a son of God, any more than any other human being of flesh and blood. For the record, the historical Yeshu was born, lived as, and died as a Jew. He and his original followers were all Jews who, like him, were born, lived as, and died as Jews. Absolutely none of them were Christians in any sense of the word. We Torah faithful Jews follow the same religion that Yeshu himself practiced. We pray to the same Heavenly Father. We live by the same Torah, mitzvot and maasim tovim. Yeshu was not a Christian, and neither are we. Yeshu's original followers were all Torah observant Jews, as was he. As Jews, educated in Torah, drenched in its teachings and what from can be seen, knowing no other spiritual path, I must logically conclude that the original writings of Yeshu's original followers were all Jewish writings, and therefore well within my domain as a Torah observant rabbi to read them and understand them as would one rabbi to another. I therefore begin with the position that anything found in the Christian Bible attributed to any of its Jewish authors that does not agree with Torah Judaism must not have been written by such an author and is therefore subject to suspicion and must be critically analyzed. And that is what I am here to do. Like many Torah sages before me, I do not accept the Talmudic Midrash about Yeshu at face value. Those teachings were meant to be polemic, not historical. Therefore, they will not be part of our discussions. Now, I've been led to perform this work because of my experiences in my personal life. As a teenager, I was victimized by a terrible evangelical group in my hometown on Long Island. This group was led by a very evil, lying, deceitful individual who turned out to also be a pedophile. I am thankful that I was able to escape being victimized in that way. Nevertheless, this individual sought to clandestinely place his minions in Orthodox yeshivot in Israel to get them to learn about Judaism with the attempt to make it easier for them to persuade Jews to convert and join their fold. I fought long and hard against this group, and I'm proud of my contributions in thwarting their efforts. It was through them and because of them that I became exposed to Christianity. And I've therefore devoted the last 40 years of my life to study and investigation to discover whatever of the truth that is still out there to be discovered. And now, after 40 years, I feel confident and ready to share my insights and discoveries with you. So again, I reiterate, I am not here to attack our God-fearing, Bible-believing Christian neighbors. I hold them in the highest esteem and respect. I'm here to explain to you, to them, to all willing to listen, what we Torah faithful Jews see when we read the Christian Bible, and why we see what we do. And now, let us proceed with tonight's lesson. Okay, with that introduction, our standard, which sets the premise for our entire course here, we are in chapter 24. We began with the first three verses of the chapter, wherein which Yeshu spoke something that did not happen. And that was, he says, that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed, that one stone would stay standing on top of the other. And we point to the western wall of the temple and said, well, I guess he didn't get that one right. Apologists will say, well, he didn't mean that wall is only the outside retaining wall. That wasn't the wall of the temple. Well, when you go and read the versions of these words in, I think it was in Luke, certainly in Mark, it clearly states that includes Jerusalem in its entirety. So, no, what Yeshu said here did not come about. But it should help us understand something. And that is the historical context of who and what Yeshu was as we understand him from our Torah point of view. And again, to reiterate, Yeshu was a zealot. He was a member of the Sicarii, the Benoni, the assassins. Our sages' initial rejection of him wasn't because of any messianic claims of the kind, but rather because of his violent nature, which we have covered in all of our courses. It bleeds through the gospel story clear as a bell. Yeshu was very much involved in creating the insurrection against Rome. He very much was looking to start a war. And with that war was going to come an apocalypse. You do not think that you are going to overturn the superpower of the day, Rome, with a wave of a magic wand, without sacrifice, without loss. Yeshu was ready to die for his cause. Yeshu was ready for many to be sacrificed for the cause. But he believed the cause could be fought imminently in his day. And that either him, or, according to our understanding of things, one of his children would inherit the throne. Yes, according to our understanding, Yeshu really was married and had kiddies, most likely a son, at least one. We'll get to that later. And throughout all of the literature, which was suppressed by the church, apparently his wife was Mary Magdalena, and she might not have been a prostitute after all, but that, again, is a totally different issue for another time. But Yeshu is involved with creating an apocalypse. Think about this, if you will, if you want a comparison, to modern times. Let's take one of the many radical extremist fundamentalist Haredi rabbis in Israel today. Very similar to the zealots of old, the Benoni, the Birioni, excuse me, not the Benoni, that means the middle guy. Birioni is referred to in Tractate Gittin in the Gemara. The Birioni, who are known as the Kanaim, who are also the Sicarii, share the same spirit with many of the extremist, fundamentalist, right-wingers that we find in Israel today. You will not have to go far. You can see it on the internet, YouTube. Many an, unquote, rabbi or Jewish person who wants to kill all the Arabs, destroy the mosque, regardless of the human rights and freedoms of these people, just kill them all. Let God sort them out. Right? Build a temple, in spite of the fact that Jewish law prohibits that today, but that's another point. They'll reinterpret Jewish law, make it the way they want it. It's exactly the spirit of Yeshu, the exact same spirit of the zealots. Nothing's changed. Think about this. If one of them was able to provoke a popular uprising in modern day Israel and led to an extremist zealot overthrow of the Israeli government, creating what we will call a Torah Taliban. Think of it like an Afghanistani Taliban type of government in modern day Israel. What kind of havoc do you think such a government could do to the world? Well, that's exactly what this zealot movement was seeking to do in the days of the Second Temple. And I put this into a modern context that I hope, push some buttons here to help you recognize the dangers of this extremism. This should help you understand what Yeshu's ideas and views of apocalypse are. You see, Yeshu's ideas and views here, in spite of what Christians do not get, Yeshu did not speak in a vacuum. Yeshu really didn't say anything here that was new, or for that matter, not Jewish. I think there are a couple of things in here that might have been added later, as you know what I mean when I say that. But when I read Yeshu's, in quotes, predictions, this is a very typical type of an apocalypse, the likes of which was predominant in Torah, Judaic literature, over at least a century or more before Yeshu's time. In other words, Yeshu is kind of like, if you will, quoting what was already popularly known. Now, I'm giving a course right now in our Monday night open forum entitled Academic Review of Post-Talmudic Jewish Messianism, in which we've discussed many of the apocalyptic scenarios that came from a period after the Talmud. Of course, in our Legends of the Talmud series, we discussed issues of that nature that discussed in the Talmud. And we've discussed biblical teachings and the like as well. We've even discussed some of these things from First Enoch. All these are lessons available on koshertorah.com. As such, Yeshu fits now into a context, a place, a milieu. So with no further ado, with this introduction, let's read chapter 24 and see what he has to say. So it says, Yeshu says to his guys here, "Take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and shall deceive many." This is one of those texts where in which I have a question mark. Did he really say, "My name, I am the Christ"? Now, a Christian would say, but of course, he's the Christ, and therefore, of course he would refer to himself as that. But Yeshu never referred to himself as the Messiah. I think that is all clearly later rendition, editing. And a lot of Christian scholars, remember this is where I learned this stuff from, they agree. So Yeshu might have said many might be coming, not in his name, saying they are Mashiach and deceive many. For anyone who knows anything about Jewish history, there's always been false messiahs. Those proclaimed by followers and those who proclaim themselves. We are unfortunately plagued with false messiahs. To this very day, the very popular movement which believed their teacher was the Messiah and then he died. So they twisted and turned Jewish theology and put it on its head and say, oh, he's not really dead, he's just sleeping, he's still the Messiah, etc., and so on. Well, no. But that's not going to dissuade any of them. So be it. Like Solomon says, nothing new under the sun. So Yeshu warns. Now you can say, am I vindicating Yeshu's words? And my answer is no, I'm just sharing with you that he said the exact same thing that many of the other rabbis of his day said the same. Rabbis always warned us against false messiahs. And there were plenty of them. Each of them was a zealot, a Biryoni, who caused terrible trouble in Israel. Moving right along. He says, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye not be troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Why must there be wars? Why must all these things be? Why do they have to come to pass? I don't know. Something about reading Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Zechariah and Daniel. There's a plan for humanity. There is a cause. There is a purpose. There is a direction. And this is just the way things are. This concept you will find is Enochian of all things. In other words, you find the book of 1st Enoch. You'll find it in all the apocalyptic literature of the genre. This is very common. You find it in the Talmud. Same thing is said. Nation shall rise up against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilence and earthquakes, right, in diverse places. Gee whiz, it sounds like, if you will, another day. These types of things happen all the time. Yeah. So what does it mean? He says, all these are the beginning of sorrows. Now, that's an interesting word, sorrows, because the Talmud speaks of a period before the coming of the Messiah, calling it Hevle Mashiach, which means the sorrow or birth pangs of the Messiah. This is a Talmudic, a Pharisaic concept. And as we've seen through our numerous previous lessons, Yeshu is clearly educated like, thinking like, dialoguing and debating like a Pharisee. So the fact that he would be teaching Pharisaic messianic teachings shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody. Essentially, there's nothing so far that's actually uniquely Christian. So far, Jewish. But then he comes and says, they shall deliver you up to be afflicted, and they shall kill you. And you shall be hated of all nations. And then it has this interesting say here, for my name's sake. Again, one of those, for my name's sake, is a curious thing. Who's going to be delivered up? The Birionim, the Zealots? Or all Jews and all Israel? What most people do not know is that when Rome fought so bitterly hard to suppress the Birioni rebellion in 70 of the Common Era, there was no anti-Semitic cleansing concentration camps in Rome and the other provinces. Granted, it'd make the Jews the nicest people, but people didn't go rise up and try to kill them all. Not at all. It was a very different attitude. But yet, anti-Semitism, when there is a upsurge in Jewish independence, it's happened in our generation. We see it today. It certainly was happening at that time too. So who is being delivered up here to be afflicted? The next verse says, and then many shall be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another. This rings something familiar in my ear from the tractate Berachot in the Talmud, which speaks of a terrible reality that existed in the time period leading up to the Birioni rebellion, as well as its aftermath. That you had many Roman collaborators and sympathizers among Israel, and they were looking for the zealot, or anyone sympathetic to the zealot, anyone who could be associated with the zealot, very McCarthyian type of mentality. And they would, you know, betray them, root them out, and kill them. There's a very famous story recorded in Tractate Shabbat of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was having a conversation with other rabbis. And they were debating whether or not all of the technological advancements and prosperity that Romans brought to the Holy Land, was it good or bad? And Rabbi Shimon says, all the good that they do it only for selfish reasons. And somehow, some way, his words got back to the Roman authorities. Now remember, Rabbi Shimon is a student of Rabbi Akiva, a man who was executed by the Roman government for treason. So therefore, if his student now is saying anything which sounds treasonous, they went after him. He had to hide out in the cave for 13 years with his son. You remember that famous story? This situation got so bad that the rabbis actually had to institute a special prayer inserted it right into the middle of the traditional standing prayer, the Amidah. It is a prayer calling, if you will, a curse on all of the traitors, backstabbers, those who would infiltrate the synagogue looking to stir up trouble and to betray their fellow. Sorry, these were not Christians who were dying for the cause of the cross. These were Jewish collaborators who were betraying their own. So therefore, the blessing was established. And we recite it to this day. Many people believe that this is a reference to the Jewish Christians kicking them out of the synagogue. Well, it might have been applied to them because they were the zealots provoking the war, creating all the strife. Frankly, I wouldn't want them in my synagogue. So therefore, we can kick them out. They might be what we'll call the mini. But the malshin, those are the traitors. Yeshu here is warning about that. And then again, a Jewish teaching, even though unfortunately it was his own students who became the betrayers. Many false prophets shall arise and deceive many, and because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. Boy, oh boy, read the stories of what happened in the days of the fall of the Second Temple. Stories of people like Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. There was such strife, division, hatred, that the concept "United we stand" was gone, and therefore "Divided we fall" was fulfilled. So he continues and says, "But he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved." And that's one of those curious languages that I got a problem with. Saved from what? Well, a Christian will say, oh, saved from the fires of hell and you go to heaven for eternity. Well, that's a nice Christian concept. But forgive me, there's no concept like that in Judaism. There is no such thing as an eternal damnation. There is no such thing as an eternal heaven or anything of the kind. So to think of it needing to be saved from your sins or saved from hell is like speaking Swahili. It's not the right language. Doesn't click. It doesn't fit in here. Maybe saved from the debacle? I don't know. Maybe the words "shall be saved" weren't the original words. So, in the time of the apocalypse, rough time, and he says, "And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come." Again, what on earth is he talking about? You didn't hear about this gospel of the kingdom so much before, did you? Where does this come from now? What is this gospel? Well, a Christian will say, well, it's the death and resurrection, salvation from sin. But that didn't happen yet. That didn't occur. So that couldn't have been what Yeshu was talking about before the fact. What was he talking about? Being that these words are so, if you will, un-Jewish, I suspect, if you will, a later editing of the text. Can I prove it? I'll let the scholars of the Christian Bible debate that issue. But yet, it doesn't fit into the milieu. Witness to all the nations? Didn't Yeshu himself say chapters before, only go to the house of Israel? He called the Gentile woman a dog. You don't want to deal with all the nations. And now all of a sudden you're dealing with all the nations? Again, a believer might smooth over that and consider it, nothing. But for those of us who come to look at this text critically, you say, wait, it is something. It doesn't fit. And therefore, again, my questions. Moving right along. Verse 15. "When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand." Well, what is this abomination of desolation? No one seems to know. According to modern Christian scenario, they're saying, well, Yeshua is going to come back, They say before that time is going to be a 7-year tribulation. Oh, by the way, all true faithful Christians are going to be taken off the earth. They're going to be beamed up to heaven. And then the only ones left to do the work will be the Jews. They're all going to suddenly all convert to Christianity and then be killed by the nations. Yes, all the Jews get killed. Gee, thanks a lot. That's the way it is. But it's very curious, because that which the Christians, the Protestants, I must say, so emphatically teach, something called the rapture, that they believe, the Bible-believing or faithful Christians, are all going to be zapped up before this tribulation period and taken to heaven so they don't have to suffer through it. There's no foundation for that teaching anywhere in the Christian Bible. That is a Christian fabrication. And though they might want to point to this one verse or that verse, there is nothing like that said or spoken of in the Christian Bible. So what is then this abomination of desolation? I have no idea. But being that he is referring to Daniel, I've covered the chapters in Daniel, which deal with Daniel's prophecy of the Second Temple period, which is unfortunately misinterpreted or misread by many Christian missionaries to try to interpret to being some reference to Yeshu, when clearly and definitively it could not and would not have been. But yet Daniel does seem to indicate that there would be a time limit for the existence of the Second Temple, the structure as well as the period of that time. Well, those ideas and beliefs were very popular and well known in Yeshu's day. People knew, not just Yeshu, but almost everybody, that the time spoken of in Daniel was coming upon them. And one way or another, Mashiach had to come, or else. So everybody was looking at Daniel. And again, if you want more interest, more information about Daniel, the Daniel classes are online at koshertorah.com. And what again, the abomination of desolation, if you go back into the original Hebrew and Aramaic of Daniel, you'll find it's not exactly what it says. But what is Yeshu referring to? Somehow, a defilement of the temple, the likes of what happened in the period of the Maccabees. You remember they put up an idol there. Now, could we have an abomination of desolation putting up an idol in the temple today? We don't have a temple. And we don't have the ritual purity to build a temple. That probably won't stop modern-day zealots. If they did build such a temple, it in of itself would become an abomination of desolation. But who knows then if there's any literalness to be fulfilled in these words of Daniel in modern times? I don't think so. I think Daniel meant for the period of the time of which he spoke, and that period's long gone. Moving right along. When you see this desecration of the temple, he says, let them who is in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down and take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. Well, wait a second. This is just such urgency? What's going on? I mean, how long does it take me to go inside my house and grab a bag? 2 minutes? I don't have 2 minutes? What's happening here? What sense of urgency? Is an atomic cloud rumbling down from us? The blast cloud of a nuclear explosion? Oh, come on. Of course not. Maybe the nation has been invaded by the forces. And if so, I mean, are we really so intense in our response here? Again, what is the nature of this intensity? He doesn't say. Woe to them that are with child, and to those that give suck in those days. Pray that your flight doesn't happen in the winter, or on the Sabbath. You see, if it was on the Sabbath day, then you wouldn't supposed to be carrying anything. It would be all called carrying in a public domain, which is prohibited law by the Torah. However, Yeshu, or the editor of his words here, are not referencing Talmudic law, which states, Pikuach nefesh doche Shabbat, that a danger of life overcomes Sabbath law. And therefore, as such, if it's a period of if it's a matter of life and death, or even if it's a question of life and death, and you got to head for the hills, take whatever you need to do it. Somebody is mentioning something in text here, which I'm going to have to deflate. Somebody says that there's a new red heifer calf born about 5 months old. Wow, that's a sign of the coming of the Messiah, right? No, of course not. Wrong. It has absolutely nothing to do with that. And how can I say that with such conviction? Because in order to sacrifice a red heifer calf in accordance to biblical law, you have to have a ritually pure descendant of the house of Aaron. Now, we have a number of descendants of the house of Aaron, we're called Kohanim today, none of which are ritually pure. And therefore, every one of them is disqualified from offering a red heifer sacrifice. And if they did offer it, the sacrifice would be disqualified. So you can't have a red heifer sacrifice. And for the same reason, you can't build a temple today. You don't have the ritual purity. We're in a catch-22 situation. Some might say that the red heifer might be a symbol, a sign, a metaphor. Well, good for symbols and signs and metaphors. Or maybe it's just the red cow that's been born. Like somebody else is mentioning here in text, the Native American tradition is the symbol of the white buffalo. Well, I don't know Native Americans going around slaughtering white buffaloes and, you know, declaring that to be some kind of ritual. I believe they consider it a great sign of things to come. We all have signs. Good for signs. But in our Torah tradition, in the code of Jewish law, we are taught not to put any faith in a sign. In all due respect, sometimes a red cow is just a red cow, and sometimes a white buffalo is sometimes just a white buffalo. Remember Sigmund Freud? Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. So, that's just what it is. And we look to heaven and pray. Yeshu is, needless to say, fanning the flames of fear. Just like much of the other apocalyptic literature of his day, including Talmudic teachings, we're doing the same. They're warning, because there's this long tradition from the descendants of the prophets. These are what we call the B'nai Aliyah, those who did prophetic ascent, the Talmudic masters of the prophetic Kabbalah, traditions that, you know, still exist in what we teach here at Kosher Torah. Apocalyptic visions of the past are kind of like apocalyptic visions of all times. And therefore, people see these things, and this is what we have in reference here. So continuing, it states, "But then shall be a great tribulation, such as was not seen since the beginning of the world to this time, nor ever shall be." Again, that's echoing Daniel, which speaks of a real hard time. "And except these days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved." Again, that word, saved. "But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened." Who are the elect? It's an interesting concept. Christians go and spiral that in so many different directions. All of this is right out of Enochian literature. And I might add, echoed in the words of the Zohar, the 13th century. It's teaching exactly the same thing. So it's interesting, because you see, in apocalyptic and Kabbalistic literature, the coming of the Messiah is radically different from that which is espoused by the likes of Maimonides, who looks at this as just a natural progression in the world body politic. On the contrary, in the apocalyptic scheme of things, the coming of the Messiah is a supernatural event which is predated by many earth changes, foundational changes in the fabric of nature, and everything changes. This is why it's considered to be a tumultuous time. And then he continues and says, "Thus if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is Christ, the Messiah," all right, he says, "believe it not." Now, we covered in our post-Talmudic Jewish Messianism course many of the Midrashic teachings about the comings of a Messiah Ben Yosef. The Messiah Ben Yosef is the one to come before Ben David, fight the wars of God, and then be killed in the gates of Jerusalem. So, who is this Ben Yosef? Well, in many of the Midrashim that we discussed in our, again, the Jewish Messianism course, no one identified him as the Messiah Ben Yosef, who is supposed to be killed. And once he dies, everyone says, okay, now Ben Yosef is dead, now we wait for Ben David. No. The literature made it very clear. Go look into the, you know, the teachings of Shimon Bar Yochai, if you remember. We covered that in, I think, the second, third lesson of the series. It said very clearly that the one who died, Ben Yosef, was interpreted and understood to be Ben David. And when he died, people lost hope that there would be a Messiah, because the one who they put their faith and trust in was dead. And then when the true Ben David came, they said, go away, we don't believe in you. They were going to stone him because our Messiah is dead. You see, all of these concepts and ideas that are, if you will, Jewish, we find exactly here in Yeshu's words. Essentially, Yeshu's apocalyptic teachings here again, except for these, shall we say, additional words here and there, are really no different from the other Jewish apocalyptic literature of the time, and I might add, for 1,000 years after. So he says again, there shall be false messiahs, false prophets, they will show you great signs and wonders, all right, and so much if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Here's that word, elect, again. That comes right out of the book of Enoch, which speaks of a certain chosen group of souls who are meant to, if you will, be God's inner circle. Where did that idea come from? You want to know where? I'll tell you where. The theology comes right out of Qumran, because in the ascetic community, they believed they were the elect. And what does that mean? Real simple. We're right, everyone else is wrong. We're with God, everyone else is against God. We're going to heaven, no, you are going to hell. That was pretty much the ascetic mentality. If you want a modern day comparison, you can look at some of the more extreme elements in the ultra-Orthodox Haredi community, where in which they seek to insulate themselves from the rest of the world, and they look at the rest of the world, you know, off the edge of their noses with disdain, with a sense of racism and eruditism and superiority, which is clearly unfounded. Well, again, that spirit of modern-day Haredism is exactly the same spirit of the old Essenes, and I might add, the spirit of Yeshu's followers who believed about themselves in the exact same way. I hate to say it, but I gotta call it like it is. That mentality is what we call today cultic. That's right, like a cult. And they create for themselves these little insular groups that they are the chosen ones. And of course, if you're not one of us, then what do you know? Well, that attitude of chauvinism and separatism, nothing new under the sun. But let's move on. Yeshu again says, behold, I have told you before. Wherefore, if they shall say to you, behold, he's in the desert, don't go. If he's in the secret chambers, don't believe it. For as lightning comes out of the east and shines even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man, again, that's that Enochian term for Mashiach, be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there the eagles will gather together. In other words, death. So you see, Yeshu, speaking about the immediate coming of Mashiach, he comes suddenly. The Talmud says the exact same thing. So again, this might come as a surprise to many Christians to realize that again, many of the teachings that they have held and believed sacred are actually the same teachings that Jews and Judaism have always believed, always done. We read the exact same things to this very day in books that are readily translated in English. Yeshu, the Jew, talking like a Jew. Again, except for the little embellishments here and there, there's nothing Christian here at all. Continuing. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, the stars shall fall from heaven, the powers of the heaven shall be shaken. Book of Joel, other apocalyptic literature, the likes of which we can still read in the books like the Zohar. Is this literal language? Is this symbolic or metaphorical language? Let the scholars and the philosophers debate it back and forth. It doesn't matter. Again, we're just putting things into its historical context. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. That's right out of the book of Enoch. And again, you'll find the book of Enoch is even quoted later in the Christian Bible, I believe in the book of Jude. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn. They shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Where does Mashiach come from? Remember the book of Zechariah, chapter 14? It says God comes with his holy ones. It's interpreted that Mashiach comes out of the sky with an army of angels. Boy, oh boy, you want to talk about extraterrestrial invasion. Coming of E.T. If that's not what's going to be interpreted, I don't know what is. But yet there's always the alternate opinion from the Psika of the Rabbati that actually Mashiach comes from inner earth and rises from inner earth with an army from inner earth. But that's not the Enochian tradition, which has him coming out of the sky. Which is it? Who knows? I guess time will tell and we'll find out. And they shall send his angels with the great sound of a trumpet, otherwise known in Hebrew as a shofar. And they shall gather together his elect, chosen ones, from the four winds, and the one end of the heaven to the other. Most don't realize that the elect groups, like the Qumran group, they are referenced in the Talmud. They're referred to by different names, obviously, because Qumran and Essene was not their authentic names. They were called the Holy Community of Jerusalem, the Ancient Pious Ones. And they were not just dwellers in the desert. They dwelt in the cities. They dwelt everywhere. But in isolated little, you know, communities of their own. So, it says here again. Now learn a parable. Oh, this is interesting. Listen to this. Learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and put forth leaves, ye shall know that summer is nigh. So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. I have heard numerous Christians refer to these words as being somehow a prophecy about the modern state of Israel. That when the original state was established in 1948, they interpret that as being the birth of the fig tree with its branches yet tender. And then I said, what? Yes, you couldn't be talking about that.
Well, how do I know we couldn't be talking about that?
Well, let's read the next verse and see for ourselves. Verily I say to you, Yeshu says, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. So the generation in which Yeshu is living will see all of these things happening, including the fig tree. So the fig tree is around in the year 30 of the Common Era, and somehow I don't think he's referring to a fig tree which is going to come around in 1948 of the Common Era. We're about 1,900, give or ball, take 20 years off. So to interpret this as an application to the modern day state of Israel, as many evangelical Christians do today, come on, has no support in their own scripture. And as it says in this own verse, this generation shall not pass, clearly contradicts that attitude. But yet, why let a good story go to waste? People want to believe whatever they want to believe. But again, let's just analyze some things. What then was Yeshu referring to about the fig tree? What is the fig tree? Well, if Yeshua is starting an insurrection, if he's creating a rebel movement, if he's forming an army in his own day, expecting that he very well might die. Now, this is something that if you look at some of the peripheral literature of the time, makes things in a greater context. You see, it is believed in Christianity that Yeshua at this time is a 33-year-old man, single. But if you go back in some of the older records, it is very possible that Yeshua might have been double that age, a man in his 50s or 60s at this time, with grown-up children, according to those who, you know, propose those beliefs. And that might very well validate why Yeshua didn't expect to live that long and to be king. And that according to those who want to believe it, this is like the Priory of Zion, the Holy Blood, Holy Grail scenario, beliefs, conspiracy theories, call it whatever you want, that he was planning to put one of his kids on the throne. We'll get to that when we discuss Barabbas. But maybe that is the fig tree of which he refers. It would make more sense to put verse 34, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Because how could all these things happen in that generation unless he's, of course, referring to somebody? But I do believe what is legit here is when Yeshua is making reference to the Son of Man in heaven coming with the angels, that he's tapping into, buying into, the supernatural Messiah concept. So therefore, if you are just a politician or a political rebel, how do you lead an army when people are expecting you to be supernatural? Well, if you are a healer and you can do all these things, it certainly augments and adds to your reputation. But where are you going to come up with an army of angels when the time comes? Think about it. If we accept as a standard messianic belief, the Messiah will come with an army of angels. It doesn't necessarily have to be true, but let's just for argument's sake say that it is. Okay, so if you now are going to be the Messiah, if you're one of these modern day right wing extremists, where are you going to get your army of angels from? What, are you going to go out to California, to Anaheim, and dress up everybody in the outfits of the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim baseball team? I don't think that's what they meant when they had angels in mind. So then what is it? Where do you get it? How do you create this supernatural aura? Well, there is very much a part of that in the Holy Blood, Holy Grail scenario and the Passover plot scenario wherein which it is believed that Yeshua himself orchestrated and concocted the crucifixion specifically and intentionally so that he could appear to have risen from the dead and therefore propagate the idea about himself as being the supernatural one. Make people believe that he would be able to manifest an army of angels and therefore get them to act and hope and pray that you'd need an army of angels to get out of it. But we all know the history of what happened. But moving right along, he says, but of that day and hour knoweth no man, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. That is a reflection to this very day of the laws of the Messiah. Again, in our Jewish Messianism class, we just covered recently the laws that state no one knows when Mashiach is coming. It is a concealed thing. Yeshua is again echoing the Mishnaic, Pharisaic teachings, which we find to this very day in Judaism. So he says here, but as in the days of Noah were, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. What does that mean? Pre-Noachian times. What happened in the days of Noah? Well, that's the time that the world was destroyed. We all remember the flood. And from the legends, we have Enochian literature and other literature. No one believed Noah. Remember, Noah had to build a big ark. If any of you have ever listened to, you can find this on YouTube, the famous comedian Bill Cosby, he did an old skit many, many years, decades now, I think, ago, entitled Noah and the Lord. Very, very funny. Where in which it's about a conversation between Noah and God building the ark and all the rest. And there's a scenario where Noah's building his ark and his neighbor comes up and says, "What you building?" "Oh, it's for an ark." Okay, what you building it for?" He goes, "I can't tell you." "Ha, ha, ha." He goes, "All right, well, give me a hint." He goes, "Yeah, you want a hint? How long can you tread water?" Now, let's take it out of the silly and bring it to real. Noah's building this big boat. You don't think people around him might have thought something was fishy, something was going to happen? Legend has it, Midrash teaches, that in the days prior to Noah, everybody knew the flood was coming. It was supposedly caused by an astronomical event, like some big meteor coming too close to the earth, ripping the oceans out of their beds, that the, in quote, scientists of the day knew it. They saw it decades, maybe a century or more in advance. They knew it was coming. But the language of the Midrash states that they knew the names of the angels and therefore expected that they could get the angels to change the course of nature. And that God thwarted them by changing the names of the angels and therefore thwarting their plans. Now let's take this out of myth and fantasy and understand it realistically. The names of the angels is a symbol, if you will, for knowing the laws of science, how to avoid that. Today, if we were going to have an asteroid 2 miles wide, one-third of the one that wiped out the dinosaurs, if that were to hit the Earth, that could wipe out all life on the surface. So, you can rest assured, the governments of the world will concoct a plan, if they don't have one already, where in which somehow, some way, they're going to get rid of that asteroid. What happens when the best laid plans of mice and men often go awry and they fail? Oops, bang. That's what happened in Noah's day. They looked at Noah as being ridiculous. You're building an ark? What are you going to need an ark? We're going to blow this thing out of the sky. That's how Noah was able to get away with it. People were so confident that they could avoid things. That is, again, what Yeshua is going. He's echoing again the old Judaic teachings. So, for us in the days they were before the flood, they were eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, knowing that the comet or whatever, the meteor was coming, and it still wasn't a big deal. Until the day that Noah entered the ark. Alright? And then they knew not until the flood came. Took them all away. They weren't suspecting. Think about this. If and when NASA, governments of the world today, saw an earth killer, an asteroid coming our way, and that there was nothing that they could do to stop it, and they knew on such and such a date, at such an hour, this mile wide asteroid is going to, bam, smash into the world and pretty much put an end to almost everything we know. Question for you. Would you warn people? Would you advise the world, telling them, duck, be prepared? Or if you remember from the old 1950s and 60s, the nuclear war drills, they'd have you duck under your desk, and you'd say you bend down there and you kiss your you-know-what goodbye. What would happen to the world if such an announcement were really made? Ladies and gentlemen of the world, we wish to hereby inform you that in 6 months and 3 days and 12 hours and 24 minutes and 16 seconds, life on Earth, pretty much as we know, it's going to come to an end. Prepare the best way you can. Have a nice day. Well, you can imagine that for the next 6 months or whatever time, all hell is going to break loose. Civilization is going to be destroyed. There probably won't be anybody left alive when the asteroid hits. Everybody will kill each other. Complete breakdown of civilization. I would agree with the government conspiracy to keep everything completely quiet so that civilization can continue to the very last moment. Without complete disruption. And try everything you can. But, what can you say? So moving right along here. I want to finish up here. I don't know if we'll have time. So he says here, "And then shall be the coming of Son of Man." So you got this big, wide destruction. Then Mashiach comes again. right out of the messianic scenario in all Judaic literature. He says, then there shall be two in a field. One shall be taken, and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill. One shall be taken, the other left. Taken by whom? Taken where? Well, that's a reference to the rapture. Really? Funny, that's not what it says. So, I got a problem with interpreting things about in ways it doesn't say. It says, watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come. Well, it's true. No one knows when the Messiah comes, even though I'm not so sure that the word he was called your Lord, but whatever. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore, be ye so also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man comes. For those of you who are familiar with the 12th principle of the Jewish faith, even outlined by Maimonides, we recite the words, I believe in perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah. And even though he may tarry, I wait daily for his coming. Meaning, and we covered this in our, again, the Jewish Messianism theory class on Maimonides, that the belief of the imminent coming of the Messiah, that's considered a law by us. You always got to be ready at all times. So again, for the millionth time, Yeshu is just echoing Judaic teachings. He says, therefore, be also ready, right? Who then is faithful and a wise servant when his Lord has made him ruler over his household? Give them meat in due season. Blessed be that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. In other words, those who are ready and waiting, fulfilling the what for us is a mitzvah waiting for Mashiach. He says, verily I say that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. In other words, when the time of Mashiach comes, those who are faithful and true will receive reward. Okay, I'm not going to bother getting into that. We have just a few minutes left here. But if and when that evil servant shall say in his heart, my Lord delays his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants, and to eat and drink with the drunken. In other words, he loses hope in the coming of the Messiah, and therefore loses his faith. Then the Lord of that servant shall come in the day when he looked not for him, in an hour when he is not aware of, shall cut him asunder, and appoint his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So again, a Jewish teaching requiring and obligating us to wait intently for the coming of the Messiah. Again, I covered this in our class on Jewish Messianism. You know something? I have it here, and I don't want to read it to you, from the words of Rabbi Yehuda Chayun in the book When Mashiach Comes. This is from our class on Jewish Messianism. And I'll just quote to you briefly. Belief in the coming of the Messiah is the 12th of Rambam's 13 fundamental principles of Judaism. Again, I believe in perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah, and even though it may delay, nevertheless I anticipate that he could come any day. Anyone who denies or doubts the coming of the Messiah, whether he does so willingly, unwillingly, intentionally, unintentionally, has distanced himself from the Jewish people, is a heretic and an apostate. Belief in the coming of the Messiah includes unconditional expectation of his arrival. I anticipate that it could come any day. He who believes in the coming of the Messiah, but maintains that it will happen in the future, has corrupted his belief, because expectation of his imminent arrival is integral to the belief of his coming. So, anything else that I want to share from this? Let me see here, just real quick. No, not really. He just says, these are the issues, pretty much. Number one, determining that Messiah may come at certain times and only various prerequisites have been fulfilled. All right, not true. Forecasting the date of Messiah's arrival and ceasing to expect him until then, not true. In other words, all those things are wrong. Saying, okay, whatever. But you get the point. By me reading to you from that Judaic source here, you see that, again, Yeshua's teaching is normative Judaism. Alrighty, I'm going to conclude here on that note, and with Ezrat Hashem, God's grace, will pick up with more of Yeshu's parables here of preparation and readiness in chapter 25, with the conclusion in that class of a very interesting way of how judgment is supposed to come on the nations. the nations are judged of all things for the crime of anti-Semitism. We'll get to that in our next class. Alrighty, so again, in conclusion, all of the apocalyptic scenarios that Yeshua said here, again with the exception of certain additions there, traditional Jewish stuff. I encourage you, go back into my academic review of post-Talmudic Jewish Messianism course, and you'll find pretty much that what Yeshua was teaching from earlier rabbis after him continued to teach. Needless to say, without Yeshua as part of that scenario. But okay, we'll conclude on that note. I want to thank you all again for joining me. I'm your host, Ariel Bart-Sadok. See you in our next class. God bless. Good night. Shalom.